Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network USA. It's always a pleasure to welcome my guest of today, who is the Northern Ireland Secretary of State, Teresa Villiers, the Right Honourable Teresa Villiers, on what is now a whistle-stop three-day visit to the U.S., taking in New York and Washington. First of all, you are welcome.
Thank you.
You brought the cold weather with you, or I don't think it would be quite this cold in Ireland, you know, or in Britain for that matter.
No, it's certainly colder this side of the Atlantic.
Tell us, I suppose it seems like the last time you were with us, and on several times, indeed, and you're always welcome here, but there has always been a big but in the presentation of what's happening in Northern Ireland. Perhaps the biggest but, and one that could have gone terribly wrong, would have made Christmas Eve a date to remember in Northern Ireland or in Ireland's history.
Well, I think you're right. Previous visits, I think I've always sought to be as positive as possible about the situation in Northern Ireland. But there's no doubt that over the last 2 years, there have been some real stresses and strains within the devolved institutions, and that pressure was really mounting over issues relating to identity in the past, such as flags and parading. And in the autumn, added to that pressure was a budget crisis relating to essentially a dispute about how to reform the welfare system. And so things were genuinely really very difficult, and that's one of the reasons why I decided that we needed to convene another round of cross-party talks to see if we could reach an agreement to sort of follow on from agreements in the past that have resolved crucial issues in Northern Ireland. And after 11 weeks and one day, we had a successful outcome. It was a long process, it was difficult, but we've made real progress on all of those issues, on those legacy ones, and on the financial ones, in terms of putting the executive's finances back on a more sustainable basis.
Can we ask about that three-month period when it seemed like there was little good news? All we learned here was that this was very unlikely to take up three very contentious issues. Obviously, the past was very much at the top of the agenda, the parades, the flags, and there was a real threat that had these discussions not turned out as positively as they did, that the consequences were unthinkable.
I think we would be in a very bad place now if the Stormont talks had failed. I think at least one of the First or Deputy First Minister might well have resigned. You know, one of the two largest parties might well have pulled out of the executive, and we'd be in the middle of an assembly election with every prospect that even once that election produced new results, you know, the institutions might not be sustainable, might collapse. We might see the catastrophic outcome, which would be a failure of devolution and a return to direct rule. Because those legacy issues were destabilising and had repeatedly sort of produced tensions. But, I mean, in a sense, even more risky and difficult was the problems in making the sums add up. If an administration can't agree on its budget, then it becomes increasingly difficult to get anything done. So I think your analysis is right. you know, we would be in a very grave situation right now. But thankfully, whilst, yeah, you know, everyone looked over the abyss, no one left, everyone stepped back, and in the end, the Northern Ireland parties found, you know, the leadership,
right,
to take things forward. They took some very difficult decisions. Sinn Féin on the austerity measures, which were particularly sensitive for them, and the unionist side in relation to new institutions on the path, which they were very, you know, I think are hugely sensitive for them. And I think, you know, there was compromise and leadership shown on both sides. And we need to be really grateful for that, because, as I say, otherwise things would be extremely difficult right now.
I suppose that from Christmas through the new year, and indeed up until now, we haven't had that much information. We know that there was that a catastrophe was averted. We know that you know, the agreements in principle were worked out. Some naysayers would say, well, you know, at the end of the day, it came down to money. But how far and what has taken place since the Christmas Eve agreement?
Well, the agreement is starting to be implemented on the side of the UK government. That means we've introduced legislation in the House of Commons to give the Northern Ireland Executive the power to set its own rate of corporation tax. That's something that, for which they've been asking for some years. They believe it could help transform their economy to enable them, because their plan is to reduce it to the same low level as is currently the case in the Republic of Ireland.
And you dragged up poor Taoiseach Enda Kenny from, you know, from my home county of Mayo to tell him that one of the primary objectives of Northern Ireland is to become their greatest competitor. I mean, you know, there's any fairness in that at all?
Well, I have to say that the Irish government, when in all their conversations with me about this issue, have welcomed the prospect of devolution, because they very much see prosperity on both sides of the border as, mm-hmm, very important. So yes, one might, common sense might suggest that they would be worried about the competition, but that's never something they've said to me. They've always been enthusiastic,
yeah,
about,
well,
granting
also
a further power to,
yeah,
Northern Ireland.
I also think, though, that something that is good for the island of Ireland, and definitely that, you know, the devolution and the tax structure to bring some kind of parity to Southern Ireland can only be a win-win for the island of Ireland.
I think so. There are, I mean, it is, many investors will perhaps view, you know, the island as a whole in making their decisions. So I think, you know, a sort of a healthy and prosperous economy in Northern Ireland is certainly in the interests of the Republic of Ireland as well. I think it's in, and that is the case actually, in terms of it's a reflection of the UK-Ireland relationship, that we both benefit from economic recovery. Obviously there are aspects on which we compete with one another, but our economies are so interlinked that actually recovery in one is a significant boost to the other.
One of the contentious issues that has been raising its ugly head for many's the long years, the issue of flags, and how, you know, how is the issue of flags being addressed, resolved? What's different this time in terms of, you know, the opposite views with respect to flags, and who should, which flag should fly, what flags, you know, the ability to get a consensus in Northern Ireland on the flags. First of all, there was a general agreement that flags, the past, that that these issues were to be, you know, that there was a general agreement that these were going to be resolved. However, there wasn't a resolution to any of those issues, were there? There wasn't a steadfast bottom line agreed on the...
Well, of the three of those legacy issues, the past, flags and parades, we made the most progress in relation to the past, with a broad-ranging set of new structures to provide a variety of ways to help and support the victims and survivors of the Troubles. One is a new police unit to enable effective investigation of Troubles-related cases and to take the sort of pressure off the PSNI and give them, you know, their to enable the PSNI to devote their resources to policing the present. A new commission for information recovery for those cases where, you know, a criminal justice outcome isn't deliverable. At least, you know, there's the prospect of victims actually finding more about the facts of what happened to their loved one, and also an important oral history project. So that, to build consensus on how to deal with Northern Ireland's past, is a significant achievement. People have been striving for it for 16 years. And that's, as I say, where we've made most progress. I think there's significant progress on parades as well. We're closer than we have been before to devolution of parading. That's, and certainly the First Minister, Peter Robinson, spoke in those terms about the agreement. But I think it is clear that there are important questions that still need to be resolved, and the next step on those matters is a set of options being produced by the Northern Ireland Executive Legal Service on how the new system would work in practice. And on flags, the outcome echoes the work done by Dr. Richard Haass. Mm-hmm. He was originally the one to suggest a commission on flags and identity and culture. That was something that I took up in the cross-party talks this time round. We'd all have liked to have, for example, a new set of principles and rules on the flying of flags, but I think the issue was just too sensitive and too difficult to get a resolution between the politicians. So I think it was quite a good idea originally put forward by Richard Haass to essentially broaden the debate, to bring more voices in, sort of engage civic society, engage the business groups, and get the wider community to input on how we might try and resolve some of these very, very sensitive issues around identity. So progress across the board, but more radically on the past than on the other two.
Now, when you're talking about progress in those three areas, still very contentious issues, are we talking about new committees? Are we talking about many of the same people who have been struggling with this continuing? Can you give us just a feel for how what's going to be different? How could it be, for instance, that, you know, it took 3 months where the entire agreement could have gone wallop, so to speak, and yet the issues are still there, but what is the agreement? The agreement is to what? To look at, to advance, to what would the issues be on each of those areas? You know, for what have we agreed to?
Well, I believe that, you know, there will be common elements with the new structures on the past. They'll have something in common with their predecessors looking at these legacy cases. But, I mean, for example, the work done by the PSNI through the historical inquiries team, you know, for many families, they valued the outcome. They found out more about what had happened, and they were very positive about the HET. But for various reasons, others were dissatisfied with it. So I think there is the idea of a fresh start to look in a more sort of comprehensive and systematic way at these issues is important. And I mean, something that I strove for throughout the talks in order to try and reassure all sides is that we wanted a process which had sort of balance and proportionality and accountability built in right from the start. Because one of the reasons why efforts in the past have failed to come up with a solution is because there was a danger of it might be sort of essentially hijacked by one side and used as a vehicle to sort of to rewrite history. And providing that sort of certainty that the process was going to operate fairly and wouldn't be one-sided was absolutely crucial to getting the final agreement.
How would you describe your own role as it seems to have new add-ons as each year goes by? Your role is, as I understand it, is much broader than keeping the peace or, you know, you're not a referee for the assembly, for the new assembly. You have an overall responsibility that has very little to do with whether debates take 12 weeks or, you know, or can be done with the snap of a finger. What is your overall role? What other issues go on, whether or not agreements are reached, or how would you define that role?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and I think that the last few months have thrown quite a lot of light on that, because if one looks at my sort of, you know, technical role in relation to Northern Ireland, I mean, it's in policy terms, it's very narrow. I have a responsibility for national security matters, but I also have a wider political role, which is to support the continuation of the peace process, to champion the devolution settlement, to work to ensure that relations between the UK government and the devolved institutions are as positive as possible. And actually, the fact that the Secretary of State's role is still an important one, even in these days of devolution, is demonstrated by the fact that when it came to it, you know, it was necessary for the UK government to be a direct participant at the talks. And at the start, I think I envisaged, you know, seeking to see the Northern Ireland parties lead in a much more sort of proactive way. But actually, there was the real sentiment that they wanted me to be chairing, you know, the meetings. And so I took a very, very hands-on role over the 11 weeks. And it was very, very hard work, but mm-hmm. I think it was, in the end, it turned out that it was, you know, to have me there and have the UK government there, you know, supporting the process, trying to move it on, was crucial. And of course, the input and involvement of the Irish government was also hugely valuable. These matters always have to be handled with care because of the sensitivities around in relation to the unionist side about the involvement of the Irish government in relation to internal domestic matters in Northern Ireland. So, but we made sure that we observed all the appropriate sort of constitutional boundaries, and we all worked together in a very pragmatic way. So I very much pay tribute to Minister Charlie Flanagan for his very valuable contribution to the process.
On the day when it appeared like this was make it or break it, and you had Prime Minister Cameron, and you had Irish Taoiseach Kenny, and they were both now sitting down with a group, and I think the understanding, definitely from the outside, as we were looking at it, a deal must be done, and this is going to be, you know, a signing off. This is going to be an historic, you know, day, fantastic photo op, because after all, this was the day when everything was going to happen. And then we saw both prime ministers basically getting up from the table and say, hey, this is not what we're here for. Go do your homework. We came because we didn't come here to act in the role of judge and jury or to take sides or anything. Was that a day for you to say, you know, oh my God, here they're gone. They were here and now they're gone and the ball is back in your court again?
Well, certainly I felt a sort of heavy responsibility fell back on me at that point. But, I mean, I think it had a powerful impact, the decision that the Prime Minister and the Taoiseach took. They were there, they had the meetings late into the hours of the night, and they both concluded that the parties were miles apart on some key issues. And I think they did both send a very clear signal that, you know, times have changed in Northern Ireland. These are all of the issues on the table were, you know, primarily devolved matters.
And they were not new issues. These were issues that had been very much to the fore. They were, to say contentious doesn't even cover it. I mean, these were very thorny issues. But I don't know whether either Prime Minister knew what they were getting into. Obviously, they had to go there, and I'm sure that the level of disappointment was pretty high. But it was also a risky period after that, because only days remained, you know, to get this, to get the deal done.
Well, it was certainly a dramatic 24 hours when the prime ministers were in Stormont House. Apart from anything else, it was very crowded because it being the era of austerity, whereas these processes used to take place in country house hotels, we had to do it all from the Northern Ireland office in Stormont. And so we had great patience from the Northern Ireland parties in relation to the slightly cramped accommodation. But I think
a lot of tea, no doubt.
And a great deal of tea. About 1,000 cups of tea and coffee were drunk, I think. And the stakes were very, very high. And actually, almost exactly a week after the two prime ministers went home, it seemed clear that it looked as if the talks were going to fail. There seemed to be every indication that Sinn Féin in particular were hardening their position on welfare and austerity, and that was always going to be key. If they were unable to compromise on those issues, we were not going to get a deal. And so I, and this view was shared very much by Minister Flanagan as well, made it very clear to the parties that, you know, we were proposing to wind things up. There wasn't any point having the same conversation week after week after week after week. And I think that, combined with the actions of the two prime ministers, was again, I mean, it was throwing down the gauntlet, the challenge to the Northern Ireland parties. You know, unless they were prepared to show leadership and make compromises, the process was going to fail, and we were going to end up with a doom scenario that we discussed at the beginning of the interview, which could have meant the collapse of the institutions. And that had a very striking effect. You know, the five parties went off up the hill to Stormont Castle, which was part of the Northern Ireland Executives building, and they worked all night, and they reached an agreement on the outline of their budget and on welfare. And I think it was knowing that, you know, that the deadline was approaching, and knowing that, you know, it was ultimately down to them, they had to come up with a viable financial package, otherwise the institutions were going to collapse. I think that was a crucial part of the success of the talks.
Following the experience just 1 year prior of, the envoy, Richard Haass, in Northern Ireland, who pretty much dealt with the same issues. And what happened in that year where, yet again, and many of us here were wondering why President Obama, why we would send another envoy over to Northern Ireland at a time when it looked like all the issues are the same. Another year has gone by, and you know, there were many rumblings and mumblings in saying, you know, sending Senator Gary Hart over to Northern Ireland at this point is a bit, in Gaelic they say upper an eshke, which means kind of a waste of time. But was there something positive that came out of, or even was there a signal that America wanted this to happen now as well?
In terms of the work Dr. Haas did, obviously that didn't result in a successful outcome, but I think it was very helpful. We were able to draw on Richard Haas's ideas and work in a way which I think was invaluable, and much of the Stormont House Agreement on the past reflects ideas that were first put on the table by Richard Haas. So, I think one of the differences, I think it was genuinely easier once the UK government was at the table, not least because in the end we were able to provide a financial package to support a deal of around $2 billion in spending power, which in these days of austerity is substantial.
And it's nothing to be, some people would say, as I mentioned earlier, tongue in cheek, okay, it all comes down to money. Well, the truth of the matter is that the money would not be forthcoming without an agreement. Mm. So it's not, it's a chicken and the egg, but the truth of the matter was that the money was not going to come, was not just going to be thrown at Northern Ireland in a budget crisis if there wasn't an agreement. So
yes, and the package is designed to specifically reflect Northern Ireland circumstances. So $150 million to support investigations into the troubles and dealing with the past.
Which is very sizable. And obviously for when you're talking about, that money going into programs that for once and for all will address a lot of those issues.
Yes, and $500 million for integrated and shared education, so that we try and deal with the segregation in Northern Ireland's education system, and money to be devoted in a sort of spend-to-save way in terms of reform of the public sector. So all of that, I think, was significant. But you also asked me about Senator Gary Hart, and I think the decision to send Senator Hart to Northern Ireland to support the process was a very good one. I think he played an invaluable role. He was, I think he showed very sort of good judgment and sensitivity around the talks. Because, I mean, the reality is, to come from another country to get involved in such sensitive issues, it's not an easy thing to do. And, it's quite easy to trip up and to alienate people. And Gary Hart avoided all of those kinds of pitfalls, and I think his sort of sensible common sense approach was helpful in securing a deal, because I think the message from him and from the US administration was helpful, particularly on the budget matters, because anyone in government in the developed world has had to tighten their belts over the last few years.
Right.
As a sort of civilization, we're all spending more than we can afford, and the sad fact was that the Northern Ireland executive couldn't be insulated completely from that. I mean, actually, as it is, their budget reductions have been very small compared to some countries, very small compared to what they've had to do in the Republic of Ireland. But I think particularly on the nationalist side, where the influence of Irish America is strongest, I think the message that, you know, having to deal with austerity and implement and make some difficult decisions was, you know, important to be able to do. I think having that message from Washington was very helpful in enabling the parties to make those difficult decisions and find an agreement.
You have met on this occasion some Irish Americans who seem to be particularly pleased, both in Washington and in New York. In blowing into Washington as you did and having very limited time there, to get the nod of approval from, you know, Bruce Morrison and indeed from other areas there, must have been pretty, well, that was new and it was very positive.
It's been great, actually. As you say, I met Bruce Morrison this morning, also figures like Paula Dobriansky, Richie Neal, and Deputy Secretary of State Blinken as well, and they've all been incredibly sort of gracious and positive about the Stormont House agreement, and really, I think, very pleased with the role played by the UK government, and, you know, very much welcoming the leadership shown by the Northern Ireland political parties. So it's been an excellent visit, and actually one thing I've shared with all of them is that we had our first implementation meeting on the Stormont House Agreement just around 10 days or so ago, and that was with me, with Charlie Flanagan from the Irish government and the five political parties in the Northern Ireland Executive. Mm-hmm. And it was a remarkably positive and cheerful meeting. You know, I think the parties were, you know, more positive than I've ever seen them, and clearly working relationships have, you know, are very, very positive at the moment after at least 2 years when they were very, very strained indeed. And I think there is the Deputy First Minister, Martin McGuinness, called for a fresh start when the Stormont House agreement was concluded, and I think so far we're seeing that fresh start. I know there'll be bumps along the road and tensions will resurface, but for the moment the news is very good.
For those of us who were obviously delighted on this side of the Atlantic with the success of the Stormont agreement, where do you see the role now for America, for Irish Americans, for the people who may feel, well, hey, this is done and dusted, thanks be to God, let's get on with the rest of our lives?
Well, the thing is with the peace process, it's never really done and dusted. I think peace is something that has to be cherished and nurtured. You know, I'm sure, to be honest, that'll be the case probably, you know, decades into the future. So the UK government is very committed to that, and, you know, continuing support from Washington is also, I think, going to be really important. And I think one form that can take is to encourage the parties to keep on the work on implementing the agreement and to carry it through, because experience in Northern Ireland shows that, you know, agreement is 10%, 90% is getting it implemented in a fair way. But also, of course, prosperity is one of the great ways to underpin peace and political stability. And I'm delighted to hear that a high-powered delegation of business figures is planned from the US to Northern Ireland sometime over the next few months. We mentioned before the possibility of a low corporation tax being introduced in Northern Ireland as a further way to bring overseas investors. Yeah. And there are some huge success stories in relation to big US companies like Allstate and Seagate and Citi and New York Stock Exchange setting up in Northern Ireland and having a great deal of success. And I think that economic relationship between Northern Ireland and the United States is going to go from strength to strength, and that's really a huge part of what the US can do to support peace and stability in Northern Ireland.
Finally, let me ask you about the relationship between, obviously, the the UK, Washington, and what are the expectations, say, from the Irish government and the Irish government's role in continuing, you know, the both the peace process and the sharing in Northern Ireland?
Well, the UK government will continue to work very closely with the Irish government on a whole range of matters, actually. I mean, certainly both governments are absolutely committed to supporting the devolution settlement and the Good Friday Agreement. And as I say, there will no doubt still be many challenges in the future, and I'm sure that the UK and Irish governments will continue to work very closely together on these matters. And our respective sort of police forces also work very closely on countering the terrorist threat. But actually, I mean, I think the relationship between the UK and Ireland goes far further than our mutual interest in Northern Ireland. We have, you know, a huge level of economic and cultural ties, and the relationship between the UK and Ireland has never been stronger and never been better, as illustrated by the hugely successful state visit by President Higgins last year. That was an opportunity to celebrate the massive contribution of the Irish in Britain. So I think the relationship between London and Dublin is going to continue to go from strength to strength on a whole range of matters,
significant
including the
role. Sometimes we get the feeling that it's not that important. You know, this is something to be worked out in Northern Ireland. The opposite is actually very true.
It is indeed. As I say, you need to continually nurture the political settlement there. No one should ever take it for granted. I think we've made a real step forward, and every year that goes by, you know, entrenches peace and stability more. But there are continuing risks, not least from whilst we've made progress on these sensitive issues around the past and identity and parading, they still have a fairly lethal capacity to destabilise things. So yes, the risks haven't gone away, but real progress has been made.
My guest, friends, the Right Honourable Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, Teresa Villiers, always welcome, and glad that you bring good tidings. Good luck.
Thank you.